What the Tech is brought to you by Glasswire. Having network issues instantly reveal bandwidth hogs, malware, and privacy-violating apps. Then block them. Head on over to glasswire.com to check it out. Hey everybody, welcome to What the Tech. I'm Andrew Zarian. Of course, I'm joined by Mr. Paul Thurrott. How you doing, Paul?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm hanging in there. It's been a, my God, you know, very hectic couple weeks.
Yeah.
Very hectic. I want to say congratulations to you.
Okay.
That your boy, Tom Brady, another ring, another championship. Yeah. Unbelievable, that guy.
He's not a bad player.
My God, really? Listen, I'm a New Yorker. I'm supposed to hate Boston, right? Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to dislike Tom Brady. I got to tell you, this is the greatest quarterback of all time. No question asked.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think anybody thought he could pull it off at 43 years old on a new team.
I know.
He did have Gronk, though. He had his buddy Gronk.
Yeah. And Antonio Brown, too. I mean, yeah. But yeah, sure.
Did you watch him get drunk yesterday?
I did. Yeah, that was pretty good.
You know, he's like a teetotaler. He doesn't really drink. I think he's...
That's right.
Is he vegan or vegetarian? He has some like crazy diet he does.
Yeah, he does. So, who knows? I can't... The pseudoscience of Tom Brady's diet is not even worth discussing. But yeah.
Unbelievable, though. So congratulations to you and everybody that's a Tom Brady fan. I'll just be here dying alone as a Mets fan for the rest of my life. You know?
You know what you were getting into.
I knew. It's a bad investment. Listen, it's like my Dogecoin investment. I bought a bunch of Dogecoin. So I'm now in this mix, and I got a bunch of messages from our viewers. They're like, you're constantly retweeting Elon Musk. Like, did you buy this stock? And people are like, you got to be careful. You're gonna... It's a sham. It's a scam. You're gonna lose all your money. I'm like, I'm done. I bought it. When I bought it, and I sold it when I sold it, and I'm finished. I'm not going to play around with this. I'm back into my ETFs and my mutual funds.
There you go.
I'm too old to be playing around with this.
Sure.
I got, you know, I could tell the conversation, hey, Jess, I blew through $20,000 on a pretend cryptocurrency. Won't work well for me.
No.
So maybe I'll buy again. We'll see what happens. But we do have a lot to talk about. You know, I had planned on talking about just the things that we're using daily and how easy certain things have gotten, like video editing. It's super simple now for most people.
Right.
Your photo collection, super easy. So for me, and you have this great article on throwout.com, and you're talking about just the updates to Google Photos. But it kind of ties into the conversation I wanted to have today. And obviously, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of other stuff. But I thought this was interesting to talk about because I forgot, because I went over to the Apple side, right? I use Apple Photos. I'm using their Photos app. I'm using an iPhone. I do upload everything to Google, and I still use Google on my phone. But it's not the primary because you're in a different ecosystem. But they are hands down so far ahead of what Apple's doing.
Yeah, or anyone else.
Or anyone else. But why do you think that is? Do you think it's the fact that they've dedicated so much to the algorithm? I'm not even talking about the editing aspect, right? There's a new video editor that you have on Thurrott.com.
No, but that stuff's great too, actually, right? Their photo editing, I'm not so sure about video, but the photo editing stuff is amazing on Google
Photos. You could do the filters, you could do stabilization for video, obviously saturation, brightness, all the other stuff, but... One thing that nobody's been able to do is the search function for photos.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, This is where the computer science stuff. I have multiple examples of this. In fact, I'm trying to think. This just came up over the weekend. It will come to me. Where you'll be talking to somebody, you know, and you're like, oh, yeah, one time, blah, 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 whatever the story is. And then you're like, oh, hold on. I can just show you a picture of it. And I don't know the date, of course. I don't know. You just search for something that, like, you know, will be in the photo. Like, I did this, this is not the story, but I did this the other day with, I needed a picture of some books I had written. So I went to Google Photos and I searched for books. I was like, beep, 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 came right up, you know.
It's not, it's amazing. In your photos.
Yeah.
So something that they do that, I see, this is the thing, right? Like, their search is very specific. You can search by black and white, by color, things like that. You can search by people.
You can search for someone's name.
You can search by clothing, by the way.
And it does that amazing. Yeah, but it knows, like, for example, like, here's what, and this will be something you'll experience as well. My kids are in photos on Google Photos from every age, from the moment they were born and were wrapped in a blanket and were in the hospital to now when they're like full-fledged adults. My son has a beard and, you know, they look completely different. But if I type in Mark and the name of my son in Google Photos, it will show me pictures from across all of his years. Same thing out on the Google-based smart display we have. You know, it's friends and family are the pictures that come up, and doesn't matter if Mark is 2 or 12 or 22. You know, like it knows the progression of this kid's life. That stuff's amazing.
Amazing. I haven't dumped in my previous photos. So right now, like for Google, it starts at 2012. For me,
okay.
When Google Photos came out, I guess, right?
Okay. Yeah, but your children were both born since then, so
yeah. So I know, have still... some actually 2011. Mine starts at 2011, but everything else before that, like I have no idea where those photos are. They're gone.
No,
I never backed it up. I never saved it.
Yeah, I have most of them up there, and a lot of them don't have. You know, it's not like I tagged any of these things. I mean. That's not completely fair. In many cases, I try to tag at least a rough date, you know, but not all of them. A lot. So there's still a bunch of stuff up there that was scanned at some point. It just has the date of the scan or whatever. But if I want to find a picture from when I lived in Albuquerque in the late 1980s or some picture from Paris or whatever it is, it doesn't. I mean, I'm sure it does in part rely on file names if that's available or whatever, or location data, but it's doing image comparison stuff. If it sees the Eiffel Tower, you know, you probably get a picture from Las Vegas, you know, that has the Eiffel Tower in it. I mean, but it recognizes the thing as well. And I it's just the combination of all that stuff that makes Google Photos so amazing.
I mean, like you could search for shorts and it'll pull up every photo that you're in shorts or a button down, you know?
Yeah.
It's remarkable. And obviously we've known this, but over the last couple months, I've been using it a lot more because I'm trying to find these photos. For my kids, you know, just like memories, I'm putting something together. And I could find when they're wearing a certain color shirt or certain color pants.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? This is so much better than what Apple does. Apple's really behind in this.
They're not even playing the same game, you know.
Do you think that's by design
it's just a different approach. It's a different background that the two companies have. It's just, you know, a different thing. I mean, Google is all about that deep algorithm stuff, you know. I mean, Apple, we should give Apple a little bit of credit. They're actually surprisingly good at that stuff as well. But I mean, I think from Apple's perspective, a lot of it might be just a privacy thing. Like some of their policies would almost get in the way. Not that Google is violating your privacy as it's searching through your photos per se, but I mean, you know, it's doing like machine learning on all the photos that get uploaded so that it can make the service better for everybody.
Yeah. There is a little bit of that, right? Like, do you want Google to be able to find nude photos? You know what I mean? If that's what you have. Do you want that as an end user and what, you know, to find nude or find bikini or something like that? I don't know. Will it be used in a weird way? I'm sure if someone gets into it, it'll make it easier for them. But I don't know how deep the algorithm goes until people start having a serious problem. I mean, you hear about it all the time now, right? People have an issue with the invasiveness of Google and all these services.
Well, I'll just say the fappening only happened to iPhone users.
It did.
We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
So,
that is right.
You know, whatever.
And I guess Apple reacted quickly to that, right?
Photos are still all over the internet. I mean,
yeah, forever for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah. So, congratulations.
Just interesting conversation to have about how far ahead it is. But I wanted to kind of touch on that before because I saw it as a lead on your site right now. You know, the top story there that you just posted. I want to go to talking about the Surface Duo. Okay. Price cuts have come.
Yeah.
They've dropped the price to $9.99. It's heading to the UK, by the way. So they went from $13.99.
Also to other countries. I should say I should update that. It's I think it's going to. Let me just look it up. Sorry, I meant to update this.
I think
article.
Germany also. Germany, France, and the UK.
Germany, France and Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Does it have a possibility of doing better in certain markets? You know, this is an interesting device.
No.
They dived headfirst into this thing. It's pretty. It's unique. But at the end of the day, who are you marketing to? And this is something that we both said for weeks on the show. Who are they marketing this product to?
Yeah, I don't know. I have a hard time with this thing. It just feels that there's so many things wrong with it. Kind of hard to even know where to start. But the central thesis here is that somehow these dual screen devices do something. You know, they make you more productive all of a sudden when what we really know is that multiple screens make you less productive. But whatever. It's always been too expensive. So I think the price cut will help. Unfortunately, because it has two displays, the amount they can cut the price is kind of limited, right? I mean, it's always going to be some amount of money, and it might be more than most people are willing to pay. But I think most people would agree $9.99 was the right starting price for this thing.
Yeah.
When it was brand new, last, whenever that was, August or September
also,
or whatever. But
they also suffered from from the pandemic, really, because – different mindset.
Well,
right? Everybody's use case shifted. Everybody's the way that we use technology right, changed okay. for everybody. And where
yeah,
before,
but I don't. I wouldn't. I can't blame the pandemic on this. Like, you're right. By the way, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not disagreeing. You're right. But this product was already problematic enough. The camera's terrible. The bezels are humongous. It's got a last gen processor. It's just. Limited use case for two screens, which has not changed in this 6 months since. I mean, you got to give them a little credit for trying, I guess. But I think anyone, even those people who wouldn't buy one now would agree, like folding displays make a lot more sense, assuming they can be made reliably. I don't know.
I mean, we're still in that middle ground. And obviously, I'm sure that the likeliness that everybody's going to come to market now with a foldable display, it got delayed by 14 months or 24 months. You know, we've gone.
Yeah.
It's the first time, actually, if you think about it, since the whole tech boom, that a global event has really affected development.
No, that's
you know,
true.
Yeah. Growth.
Yep. There's been this push to these kind of new form factors, like folding displays and two displays and, you know, devices that can do more than one thing. And that's all very interesting when we're moving around and commuting to work and traveling and everything. And so, yeah, like you said, I mean, the past year has been a nice reminder. It's like we can kind of dick around with this stuff. But the reality is when you need to get work done, a PC form factor makes sense. And that could be a Mac or a Chromebook. It doesn't have to be a PC. But
here's the thing, Paul. It made sense for most people, right? Like we've joked. I mean, we've always joked about who's the guy that gets the job done on an iPad, you know, typing away on the glass. You told the story about, you know, there was me too. It's happened. You know, we used to travel a lot. Now nobody's traveling, but on the plane, just type it on glass.
Yeah. I mean, this is a luxury, right? I mean, so when everything's going fine and the money is flowing freely, I mean, you can kind of screw around and say, well, maybe I'll try. It'd be nice if I had one device that did these two things, you know, but you know, when the shit hits the fan, like it did in the past year with the pandemic, it's like, oh, no, I need a, you know, you stop screwing around. You know, it's like, no, I need a computer.
No, I need to get work done. I need a computer. Yeah. It's interesting how everybody bounced back to that. It's the way people use technology. I mean, forever, it's going to be changed now, right? Things came up that people never used. We talk about Zoom all the time. Telecommuting has become such a norm where people that never would have done this are now realizing I'm way more productive this way. I don't have to go to and travel, you know, 2 hours to go to a 30-minute meeting or travel 45 minutes to go to a 30-minute meeting. I could just do it on my phone in my you know, underwear in my kitchen and I got it done.
Do you find yourself like have things changed for you to the point, because you're not going, I mean, you actually tend to kind of commute a little bit more than I do even now, but I find the smallest trips to be onerous now. Like my wife will be like, we should go pick up some wine this weekend. It's like a winery. It's like 20 minutes away, maybe 25 minutes from here. And it's like, oh, like, I don't know.
Crap. I got to go.
Yeah. I don't want to go that far.
You know what?
You know,
it's funny because I just said this to someone. I have to go.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you were hearing the conversation. We were doing Mad Men before, and I said, mm-hmm. I'm like, shit, I got to go to the liquor store to buy wine because Jess is home tomorrow and she wanted to make dinner and have a glass of wine tonight. So I'm like, ah, crap, I got to go. I'm like, but I got to go. Like, I got like 10 minutes I could go, but I don't want to go when it's rush hour and people are driving. Like, I'm like, normally I wouldn't have cared, but you're absolutely right. My everybody's thought process has shifted. You kind of want to use your minutes up properly. You know?
Yeah.
I don't think people want to.
I mean, but you know, for example, like there's a part, of course, I've traveled so much, right? And I want to go experience things. I want to go do stuff. But then I think about the logistics of it and I'm like, "Oh, do I like do I really want to go through this?" Like,
well, also, you got to, like, I go into work most days now. Right.
Yeah. So
I do it out of guilt. I'm doing it out of guilt because I'm still getting paid. So I feel like I have to do something. So I go in and I take the train every day and I take the subway every day. You know, like an idiot to go and sit in an office all by myself for 3-4 hours.
Well, leave. You know what though? Okay, but hold on a second. So I mean, honestly, psychologically, that might actually be smart, right? You know, one of the things we've learned from this, you know, a lot of people that used to go into an office every day is they really do miss the commute, you know, because the commute gives you that transition between work and home, you know, and maybe that's what you're doing. I mean, maybe that's what you miss, you know, even if you haven't really thought of it that way.
You know what I hate though?
Or maybe you hate your family. I don't know.
Maybe.
Either one.
It's what I'm going to say. It's going to come out wrong. I hate the commute back home.
Yeah.
Because that's the reminder to me that nothing is normal still. Because normally my commute back would be, you know, hey, I'm on the 5:14 train. Jess, put on something. Let's get dinner. Or you want to meet up for a drink? Or do you want me to pick something up? Who's coming over tonight? That's gone. All I'm doing now is just walking home. I get off the train. Yeah. I walk home. That's the part that I hate, is that I don't even have the availability to say, you know what? I'm going to stop for a drink.
Well, but that will change over time, and maybe that's what will make this year kind of nice for you. Yeah. Oh, starting to, right? Because aren't you getting are you going back up to 25% or whatever? Is that what?
So New York is going back up to 25% tomorrow for indoor dining, and they're going to be allowing major sporting events to happen at 10%.
There you go.
So you could have, you know, the Garden. You could go see the Knicks. You could go see the Rangers. Whatever.
But I got an email from a band about a socially distanced concert they're doing over two different nights in late March in Atlanta, you know, and it's like, I'd kind of like to go to Atlanta. But I don't know. It might be too soon for that kind of thing.
I have a vacation coming up this summer and we're debating if we're going to Grenada.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. We'll see.
Have you seen any metrics for people on video, you know, playing video games, if that's going up or down now? Because originally
video game,
it was sky high.
Yeah, it still is. It's through the end of the year, it is. Yeah,
it's interesting. I mean, just the way that we're using these services has totally shifted. Very much so. I mean, listen, big story this week, right? The last couple of weeks. We didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I kind of wanted to talk about it because it's technology related, is how the stock market, the way that people look at the stock market and perceive the stock market has totally shifted because a whole new generation of people have been able to disrupt what has traditionally been the way that you invest money and the way that you...
Usually it requires con men and financiers to manipulate the market.
Yeah. And now anybody... Do you think there's a long-term negative to this, or do you think this is going to be a positive?
I think this is going to have to be regulated because, look, we've seen this is exactly like the conversation we've had all the time about one day, 15 years ago or whatever, someone woke up and turned on their little phone or a computer or whatever, and they had some app, and it was like, hey, check off the topics you're interested in. And you were like, I don't want politics. I don't want religion. I don't want whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you go down this tunnel where you only see the things you want to see. It sounds like a great idea in the beginning, but then the net result is social networks undermining our democracy and people believing that the election was stolen and this is an assault on Capitol Hill. And so you can see what happens like on the political front. Mm-hmm. The money stuff is just as bad, right? Of course, because people are going to lose their life savings from this kind of stuff. It's just as life altering in a negative way.
Well, here's how I see it, right? Mm-hmm. There will be people that become very, very wealthy.
Yeah, of course, okay? They will.
Like, yeah. And I'm not talking about people that know what they're doing. I'm talking about just right. on
I want to be one of those chance. People. I want to be clueless and buy Bitcoin or something.
I'll give you a great example. When I was 18 years old, after 9/11, right? I was 17, right after 9/11. I took my life savings as a kid, right? Birthday money and everything. And I dumped it into the stock market. You know what I did? I listened to the worst people. I bought extremely
who are the worst risk. People?
My shady stockbroker friends.
Okay, I thought you meant like Dave Ramsey. But no, go on.
So, I mean, I would have been better off. But I listened to these guys that were like, but you could put in $5,000 in this and the return will be. You know what? Luckily for me, I made money. But that is not the story for most. And listen, I don't know enough on the regulation aspect of this to talk about how do you regulate people convincing other people to purchase stocks and doing mass pump and dumps the market.
Because in a regulated banking economy, fiduciary trust and any fiduciary is legally bound to be working in your best interest. And what you just described is a scam. It's a difference between convincing and manipulating. Like you're obviously driving up the price of a stock of a company that's probably about to go out of business. I'm convinced people like AMC or GameStop is a good investment. It's like, I'm literally manipulating the market. Like it's not a good buy for anybody. It's not a good company.
Yeah.
So that needs to be regulated. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
So it's interesting where people fall on this. Cause I like the fact that this is not politicized yet. You know what I mean? Like I like that. I mean, and I'll tell you why. I have people, a lot of my friends, stockbrokers, shady hedge fund guys, they're all over the place with this, right? The hedge fund guys have been doing this for many, and I'm not saying all of them, but many hedge funds do this. This is what they do. They decide that they're going to pump into a company, drive it up, let other people get sucked into this, and then they're going to sell it at the point that they know that when it's going to collapse. It's still a hedge fund. There's some, even though they're not heavily regulated like a brokerage firm or a bank. They put the hedge in hedge fund. But now when you have 16-year-olds narrating what people should buy.
I know, it's crazy.
And investing, and you don't know as an end user, right? Like me, I don't know if this guy on Twitter that's saying buy Dogecoin or whatever. Like that I have a problem with. Like Elon Musk tweeting about Dogecoin, I know what he's doing.
That sentence though, a lot of people don't know what he's doing. And that's the danger of someone like him, you know, frankly. Because people just blindly look up to a guy like that. And he's the richest person on earth.
Listen, even if he's not buying it, I think he said that he bought it for his son, like as like a joke. But he's buying it as a joke. Another person's putting their life savings in. You know,
that's the plot of Schitt's Creek. Look, I mean, this guy. You go back 25 years. Bill Gates, right, richest person in the world in the mid 90s or whatever. Bill, what do you recommend for people wanting to build wealth? He would say, put money in mutual funds and leave it alone. You'll be fine. Yeah. S&P 500, whatever. And he's right. You know, Warren Buffett, same thing. Elon Musk is like smoking pot and he's talking about buying Bitcoin as a joke. I mean, what the this is a completely different kind of person, right? It doesn't mean he's not a genius. It does. Obviously, he's an incredible genius and businessman and whatever. But I don't know that anyone should be. He doesn't have lessons to teach anyone. About
of cryptocurrency. In the past, he has said many times that he is not a fan of cryptocurrency.
Okay.
Well, he doesn't see it as like a safe bet. I find it interesting, but it says something about how we as people, we're still so gullible.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that people did not get rich on AMC or on GameStop or Dogecoin or Bitcoin, whatever it is. But
yeah, but they did it at the expense of really stupid people who
bought into whatever nonsense. There's 10 of them that have lost so much money.
And that's the thing.
It's the same. Listen,
ruining lives.
We've had this happen for centuries. The guy, the door-to-door snake oil salesman, he's selling you a freaking elixir.
Yeah, but the scope of this is one thing when you hand over $20 or whatever for something that doesn't do anything, versus your life savings maybe or whatever, you know, some substantial amount of money.
You know, this goes more deep into that conversation, and we're eventually. I gotta figure out how we could have that conversation about the internet and where it's headed and where we're going. Yeah. You know, forget about.
I gotta send you an article. I wonder
aside
if I
from the political stuff, really, like forget about the political aspect of it, but in general. The internet that we know today will not be the internet in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. It's going to become something totally different. And I think we have somewhat learned that we as human beings, we're still very tribal by nature. It's in our mind. And when I say tribal, I'm not saying a tribe in the middle of the jungle. I'm saying we're tribal where we like things a certain way and we like what we know and what we like and our traditions. And we have a very difficult time listening when someone says, hey, maybe that's not the way to do things. Maybe this way also works. Or maybe these people need this. I think we have a very big problem with this. And it's such a difficult conversation. You need a panel of people that know way more than me to talk about this. Yeah. I'm always fascinated by the discussion of what the internet will become, because that's always something.
Well, there's all these little, so there's hints here, right? If you're familiar with what the Brave browser does, with trying to kind of flip the script on advertising on the internet and how you can pay content creators and so forth. Australia is trying to enact a law that would prevent companies like Google and Facebook and others from scraping content and just republishing it around their own ads. Google and Facebook have come out against this this change. Microsoft is supporting it wholeheartedly. In fact, after we're done, I'll write this up, but they just came out with an editorial where they think the entire world should work on this basis. And over in the corner, you got Tim Cook doing everything he can in iOS to make the Facebook and Google business model fail. Right. So yeah, there's a change coming, right? I mean, we'll see. And add on top of that, all the regulatory and antitrust stuff that's going around, in particular around Google and Facebook. Right. So we got to this point. It didn't quite work out the way the founding fathers of the internet thought that maybe it should have, I guess.
Things
are definitely going to change.
I specifically remember, I want to say 1999. Mm-hmm. I specifically remember I was a kid, right? I was like, I need Office. I just downloaded Office, got Office. I needed this app. You download this app. And I remember specifically saying, this is not going to last. this internet,
right?
And it didn't, right? We saw.
I did that. That music was like that for me. I remember
music, movies, music.
Napster, and then the things that came after Napster,
and Morpheus.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, right. Something. Okay, I'm having trouble remembering some of the names, but
Audio Galaxy. I want to say.
I don't remember anyway, but there was just a period of time where it was like this. This is illegal. Like, this is just not going to...
And it's not going to last. Listen, FTPs. Yeah. Remember, let's talk about that. The BBS BBS forums.
You know,
you could... It was a very different time. And the fact that we've experienced this, it says a lot, right? This is before that there was a front page to the internet, like Facebook or AOL or Reddit.
Right.
You know, we've had multiple Yahoo, front pages. Yeah. Yahoo. You really... It was the Wild West. And... We're now in this transitionary period of redefining what we think the internet should be.
It seemed like it was going to work. Back in the day, I'll just say from a content perspective, I was randomly going through some old files. I came up with like I guess I'll call it a royalty statement from maybe 2011. It was a long time ago. And it was a pretty good chunk of money, actually. And I was kind of looking through the numbers and like where all the money came from and everything. And of course, I only got like 33% of it. So my company did even better than I did. But it was a lot of it was Google online advertising stuff. And that all disappeared one day because, you know, Google, as the gatekeeper to advertising on the internet for the most part, especially back then, eventually were like, well, we can make these terms better for ourselves. Everyone needs us. It's not like they can go anywhere else. And, you know, ads on the internet went from being something sustainable that businesses could be built off of and it would actually make money and you could be a publication, to unsustainable. And so the only way you can respond to unsustainable is to start being more aggressive with the ads, more and more ads, which everyone has experienced. That's not a shocker. And then different business models, you know, we do the premium thing or whatever. People start selling crap off their site or whatever it is. Like this, you start doing different things. But to me, I mean, maybe it wasn't sustainable from Google's perspective. It seems like they were doing pretty good. But I think when Google did that cash grab, and it's only gotten worse since. I mean, that's been the big shift. And that's one of those problems when you have like a gatekeeper, because people are like, oh, what are you doing? They, you know, what's the problem? They give us the answer to every question we have. It's like, well, they also siphon the, you know, the spigot down to nothing. And so all the money's staying at Google. It's not going out to the content creators.
But, you know, like Google's a big thing, right? They're the front. They control essentially if you're seen, if you're not seen.
Yeah.
They prefer you to pay them to be seen. That's the model. That's the model for everybody. Twitter follows that model where and this is a big problem that I have. If I have 100,000 followers, right? And I'm putting out a message, I'm writing, whatever. I'm live with Paul at 1 o'clock.
Right.
Shouldn't those 100,000 people have the opportunity to see it when I put it out rather than whatever service I'm using, the algorithm defining who gets to see it when? Where since I've had a conversation with you, you now get to see it, but somebody that followed me 6 months ago, maybe they're not going to see this post ever. That's a problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem with any gatekeeper. I mean, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook all do that. All of them, to some degree.
But here's the thing, in their own little worlds, you know. The fact that I have to take out an ad to reach my followers...
That's
like I'll put out a tweet, I'll put out a message on Facebook, and it'll pop up like, "Hey, by the way, this is doing really well. It's performing really well. 5,000 of your 20,000."
Yeah, but I mean, you understand, Facebook's doing the same thing, right? I mean, there isn't a single human being on Facebook who doesn't expect and would be surprised to discover that their newsfeed is not what they think it is. Like the newsfeed should be the most recent post from my friends. Like that should be what it is all the time. And they changed that without telling anybody. And then people found out and they got mad and now there's a switch you can do, but it doesn't always take and whatever. But I mean, most people would assume when you're on Facebook, what's new on Facebook? I'm going to see what's new. That's the whole thing. And it's like, no, you're not. You're going to see the things that are targeted at you.
Well, Twitter's the same exact way, right? But Twitter, it's even worse because Twitter's pretty news-based. Your tweets
Well, it's an of the moment. Yeah.
It's an at the moment service. So
it's a live reaction thing.
Yeah. So if I put out a message and you see it 2 days from now, what point is it? What good is that?
Right.
Unless I pay. I could always pay.
Yeah.
You could do newsletters now on Twitter. I don't know if you saw that feature.
Newsletters. No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. There's a newsletter feature. You could publish your own newsletters and you can get paid for your work. Yeah. They're working with
another company. Get paid for my work.
Yeah.
Well, that would be fun.
Looking for another way to reach your audience? Get paid.
God, am I looking for another way to reach an audience? Jesus. I just want to do what I do. Could I not? I hate having to think about stuff like this. It's the worst.
Now the big question lies, do these services become more algorithm heavy or do they realize that their user base doesn't want this?
It does. Yeah, but this is the math that the real math of what they're doing is, how can we do enough of what we need to make as much money as we can without pissing off the people who are starting to notice, hey, my feed is a lot of this other stuff. It's not my friend Bob and his kids and what's going on over there. It's, you know, it's things that are targeting me instead. It's a fine line. It's actually a pretty gross crayon based line, but I mean, it's, I don't know. We talked about this with the, the financial stuff. I mean, this is like an area where regulation is required. And I hope that the antitrust stuff, across the board. And I think of all those companies, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google. I hope it solves this stuff, because this is a huge problem.
Yeah, it is changing, and not for the good, I should say.
Well, yeah.
I don't think it's changing. I think a lot of these companies, listen, and it's my choice. I don't have to be on there, but unfortunately for me, my livelihood is tied to social.
Yeah.
Dude, if I never did this, if I did not do podcasts, I would not be on Twitter. I probably would have never installed Twitter on my phone. I think it's one of the most toxic places you could be. I think there are a lot of sick people on there, more than I would imagine. Like hashtag following, right? There are people that wait for someone to use a hashtag that they don't agree with, and and they're just sitting there following the hashtag so they can argue with you. And it's not even like a productive, like I follow things for like podcasting or wrestling because I cover it, or technology. I cover, you know, a hashtag, like a trending hashtag. I'll see what people are writing about a certain product that came out. But if I'm writing like New York City, hashtag NYC, right? Mm-hmm. If I use NYC in my thing and I write something negative about the governor.
Yeah, then you'll get, yeah.
Then the I'm getting like swamped. And I'm wondering, I'm like, where did you find me? I just wrote NYC and you're searching for it.
Yep.
I think.
This is 50% of my online existence is dealing with this kind of stuff.
I know.
Well, I mean, I write about something about Apple. Like I'm doing this M1 versus Intel Evo thing. And it just brings out the trolls. You know, they're like, you know, you can tell this. Well, we'll see if you could be fair, you know, Windows guy, you know, and it's like.
That you're going to be fair to who? You're going to be fair to Microsoft?
Fair to Intel? Apple in this case. You know, no.
You've been very.
They're
pro.
Just waiting for the bias, you know, like they go into it with their bias, you know. So it's like, just want to let you know I'm going to be monitoring this series to make sure you don't go off the deep end. It's like, thanks. I'm not sure how I existed online for the previous 25 years, but I'm glad you're finally here. Thank you.
Since you brought it up, I want to get your opinion on this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you hate Apple now?
Do I hate Apple now?
Yeah, want to know, Paul.
No. Actually, so switching gears here. Sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack this. I like that Intel is finally stepping up and speaking out for itself, right? So Apple's kind of dominated the news cycle since they did the M1 stuff. And my experience, I've had two of them now with the M1-based Macs, is hugely positive, right? It's they've done a great job with it. There's still compatibility issues. There are still limitations to things that you can do, you know, multiple displays, external GPUs, all these other things you can't do with an M1-based Mac. But, you know, I think we all kind of expect maybe over time that stuff will improve with future models or whatever. But just comparing where they were, battery life and performance, with where they are now, it's night and day, and it's a great thing for the Mac. I think the central place where I align with what Intel is saying, aside from all this stuff about compatibility and all that stuff, which is all true, which is fine, whatever, that's whatever. This is something I had come to independently. This is not an idea that Intel injected into my head, and you'll know this because we talked about it months ago. Which is, I'm not really sure that we in the PC community have anything to learn from what Apple has done. I don't think there are lessons that can be applied to the PC and just directly applied across. And the reason is Apple does everything that Apple does for itself, not for its customers, by the way, for itself. It eliminates partners so it can be the sole provider of everything. It's very much into this curated experience and just deciding on the part of users what the right decisions are.
Yeah.
Whereas in the PC space or the Android space or whatever, you get like a lot of different choices and you get different visions of what a device can be, what software can be, what whatever. So all kinds of different things. So I'll just say, an Apple, like a MacBook Pro maybe went from 6 to 8 hours of battery life to 12 to 15 hours of battery life. And that's great for a Mac. We already have PCs that get that kind of battery life. And by the way, the ARM-based PCs we have get 25 hours of battery life. They're just crappy computers, but they get lots of battery life. So we've experienced that stuff, you know. Apple's unilateral approach to everything is not something that would ever make sense in the Android or PC worlds, because those are all partner-based. You have a platform maker and you have a bunch of companies making hardware. And they all do their own thing, and that there are pros and cons, you know, for sure, but it is what it is. Like, Apple has always gone it alone, and the PC industry has not. So the M1, it's like, okay, well, technically amazing, great job. No major complaints from me, for sure. I just don't think there's a lot that we can learn on the PC side from this. Like, I don't think, Apple did what was right for Apple, you know? If you're a Mac user, by the way, you'll benefit as well. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if you're looking at what Apple does, Apple's, you know what it's like? The Apple's baseball, right? They're MLB.
Okay.
Their audience loves MLB. They like baseball, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on the PC side, you're the TV network. You have you have baseball.
Sure.
But you know what else you have? You have comedy, you have drama, you have this, you have that. It's way more difficult to do a one-size-fits-all solution when you have so many different interests and user base. And your user base is broad. Listen, the Mac user base is not as broad as the PC one. That's a reality. That's not a knock at Mac users. That's not a knock at the Mac user or Apple user, but other than the phone market. But if we're talking PCs...
Well,
what Apple has done with their PCs, their computers, was far easier for them to do because they had a far smaller user base that didn't have all these specific needs that the PC world did.
There's also the big thing that's been going on to me for the past few years, regardless or whatever of M1 is. There's been like this big thing about benchmarks every year, and like some new Apple chip will come out. And it's like, oh, it blows away a Core i7, or it blows away a Qualcomm Snapdragon, whatever the biggest thing is today. And it's like, okay, that's cute. But I use PCs all the time, and I use different Android phones all the time. And I got to tell you, these things are not slower than Apple devices. They're just not. So benchmarks are fascinating, but real world use, like, that's not a thing. The real world advantages to what Apple is doing has to do with such things as power management and fans and lack of heat and all that stuff. And in their case, battery life, because they just didn't have that before. Those are advantages. There's no doubt about it. But the PC market is so much more legacy based. And the reality is we still rely on these fairly ancient, applications, frankly. And those things are x86. And we just, we've been trying, we can't get past it. And getting those things to run is job one. And like on, Apple did their, they did their compatibility, how they did it. Microsoft's been working on it a different way. And the ARM stuff on the PC side just has not done as well. But the thing I feel like is happening is you start off with these devices that have terrible compatibility, poor performance, but they get 25 hours of battery life. And so Microsoft and Qualcomm are like, well, how do we fix this? And so obviously they do as partners what Apple's doing internally, which is they adapt the software and they adapt the hardware to the software. And the problem is what we see on the Microsoft side, the Windows side, is that as they do that, the performance starts to inch up. The chips are getting better. That's good. The compatibilities get a little better, right? They're adding the X64 stuff. We know that's happening. But the battery life goes down, right? So now, like, instead of, 25 hours, it's like, well, 16 or 20 hours maybe, or something like that. So at some point, they're going to adapt the ARM chips enough so that they run x86 code really well, but then they're just not going to get really good battery life anymore. Yeah. So why did we go through this exercise again? The Intel Evo thing, by the way, is it's a specification of sorts by Intel, so that a laptop that gets that logo, that sticker on it, which everyone loves stickers, comes with certain promises, Wi-Fi 6 connectivity, 9 hours or more of battery life, certain levels of performance. They have these new integrated graphics chips that basically are as good as dedicated graphics, and they're getting better and better. And that's super interesting because that makes the PC more useful for different workloads, including games, right? On a normal Ultrabook now. So it's just Evo is not a response to M1. It has nothing to do with it, really. But the point of Intel wanting to have reviewers like myself compare an Evo or one or more Evo laptops to M1 based laptops is that they both represent the state of the art for those particular platforms. These are what modern PCs look like. This is what you should compare against an M1 based Mac. And it's not, you know, it's not like the 2-inch thick Dell laptop they're all used to from 1998. Like, these things have evolved. You know, they're much nicer now.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I like right now I'm looking, they have verified laptops here that you could pick from, right?
Yep.
They got a Razer. Yep. They got an HP Spectre convertible and a Dell XPS 13.
These are, I literally have every single one of those computers in my house right now.
They're all great. And all three of them are great.
Yeah, they're all fantastic.
You have the Razer Book?
Yeah.
How do you like it?
13, yeah. I like it. Actually, that's the one I chose. So Intel came to me with a list. They're like, you can take all of these, you can take some of these or whatever. And I'm like, I just want one. I have way too many laptops in my house at any given time. I chose the Razer because I already had or will get all of the other computers they were offering, the HP Spectre X360 14 or the Dell XPS 13, whatever. But the big reason was I don't have a relationship with Razer. I've never reviewed any of these products. I'm familiar with them as a company. I know that their background is in gaming. And I know that the Razer Book 13 is their first stab at like a productivity-oriented laptop. And in part, one of the reasons it's interesting is because it has these, I think it's called Iris Xe graphics. It has that chipset built in. And this thing is a very low end, but a low end gaming computer. It can do modern games at 1080p. And, that's interesting. I mean, that's another example of how the PC is, you know, kind of evolving. So I chose the Razer just because I'm not familiar with it. I wanted something new, you know?
Yeah. It's a nice looking computer for sure.
Yeah. It's comparable, I would say, to the MacBook Pro. I mean, from a price perspective, depending on the model, one is either cheaper or less or more expensive, depending on which, you know, model you get or whatever, but they're right in the same space.
I mean, listen, Intel does not have a choice in this. They have to adapt.
Well,
they have to do something.
Yeah. This is early. I don't mean, I'm not delivering like a conclusion here, but from where I sit today, I will say this. What's going on with ARM in the world broadly, not just with the M1, but just broadly, and this push toward mobility is an industry shift that will take Intel with it or leave them behind. There's no doubt about it. I think the biggest risk to Intel is in a market that I don't really care that much about. It's in the data center. And when you have silicon and chipsets and computers that can run cooler and consume less energy and require less cooling, that's better for everyone, especially when the performance per watt is at a high level and you get really good performance. And that's where ARM's going to really hurt Intel. Intel is going to need to adapt its data center-oriented chipsets to meet that threat. There's no doubt about it, because that's going to be a huge future for any company that decides to play in that market. The PC space, today, it is about 50% of Intel's revenues for sure. But when you look at the broader market, if you compare it to IoT or the data center or to any kind of mobile platform, especially smartphones, the PC is a minority player. And so Intel is the big fish in what is an increasingly small market, but they're not the big fish in the big markets, or they won't be soon. They're not a big fish in mobility for sure. They're not a big fish in IoT at all. And right now, actually, they are a big fish. And I, the other half of their revenue, most of that comes from data center chips. But that's where they're vulnerable. I don't think the M1 is going to harm Intel that much, short or long term, other than the fact that there will be a natural evolution of the chips. And they're going to do efficiency cores and performance cores and all that. So they're already doing that stuff that's happening, that kind of ARM architecture type stuff. But from a volume perspective and eventually from a revenue perspective, the big deal for Intel is going to be data center, and that's something they have to figure out. And I don't care about that. So that's all I will ever say about it. I have nothing else to say. Like, they just need to fix that. And they can do that off on their own. I don't really care what happens there, but that's how I look at it. So that's where I'm at.
No, I don't think it's going to ruin the PC market, but I think it's going to add more of a reason for people to adapt ARM. I think that's what's going to happen.
So, but this is a flow chart, and the flow chart to date on the Windows side has resulted in an exit from the flow chart in the first step, because the first question in the flow chart is, does this thing run everything I need it to run? No. then the rest of it doesn't matter. And then someone's over there waving their hands, but hold on a second. It gets killer battery life. It does. There's no fans. So it's like runs really cool. And you're like, yeah, but does it run everything I want? No, then I'm not even, it doesn't matter. I think the one thing that Apple has done right, but it's also a combination of that and their history of really aggressively getting rid of old technology.
Yeah,
is they've made that first question a yes for most people, right? For the most common stuff, you'll get those peripheral issues where it's like, well, can I use more than one external display? No. Okay, then I can't. You know, this yeah. eight people that need that, or can I run an external GPU? Can I run whatever the things are that don't work with the M1 right now? So for some people, there's like these little issues, but for mainstream people, Apple's kind of answered that question. So they made the flowchart kind of come up, you know, as a winner, not an early exit.
Since we're still on the Apple thing, and this was mm-hmm. a quick show today. It's been a hectic day.
Yeah.
What do you think of this Apple car story that everybody
Well, so unfortunately, Hyundai and whatever the other company, maybe Kia, have both come out and said, this is not happening. So I feel like Apple making us, or at least participating in some kind of an autonomous vehicle, whatever it is, self-driving vehicle, it feels inevitable, right? Like this comes up every couple of years. Like this is a, you know, they're obviously working on this, and they have been working on it. But it seems like every time something is about to happen, there's you get the alternative, you know, the other rumor, like Hyundai saying we're not doing this, or people exiting the company and going somewhere else, or
what do you think the end goal with it is? Is it to produce a service, yeah. or is it to create a you know, an electric car to change the industry?
I don't even know. I mean, this reminds me of the rumors. This was right around the time Steve Jobs died, right? Apple, remember Apple was going to come out with a TV. Not a TV service, not a TV, Apple TV dongle thing or set-top box. They were coming out with a TV. And of course, when you hear something like that, or they're coming out with a TV. Car. Remember, these are the same thing. It's like, so now what you start a bunch of debates between people who care about this stuff about what form this thing will take and why it makes sense for Apple, where it might not make sense for other companies, or what are the risks and blah, 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 whatever, you know. And I, you know, cars and TVs are big.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not the types of things you replace all that frequently. And I feel like those two things make them contrary to what Apple and their business model is all about, you know, which service. Is low friction, high upgrade. Yeah. And, yeah. you know, getting people on a monthly.
The hardware is a service. The hardware, I mean, they have yeah. an upgrade program.
Yeah, yeah. I guess a lease technically is a subscription service. I don't know, but I
can see them doing that. I can see them saying that you cannot buy the car. You can only lease the car.
I feel like, I don't know. I just don't know. I feel like it's too early. When you think about companies like Tesla and electric vehicles and all this stuff, I mean, cars are one thing, but I honestly feel like something that would make a much bigger impact on society at large, just not just driving, but climate and everything else, would be replacing all of the 18-wheelers on our highways with electric vehicles yeah. of some kind, replacing trains with electric, if they're not electric, actually most of them probably are electric, you know, replacing lawn equipment and snowmobiles and boats and, you know, whatever, like it's not just cars. It's like everything needs to be converted this way. Right. So why would Apple want to be part of any of this? I mean,
here's the other thing. Have you seen the prototypes for what it could look like? Right. None of them.
The Apple thing?
The Apple car, right? The Apple car look. None of it is like aggressive or like a beautiful car. It's like a bubble.
Yeah.
That's what which is interesting because that's what people perceive Apple to do. They don't see them creating a regular car. I think it's just going to be a regular car with Apple services. Much like that
I think
HP
we're always,
device that they put out many years ago.
There's always going to be pushback from the traditional car companies that would naturally be suspicious of technology companies, which they should be.
Yeah.
They're suspicious of Tesla, you know, like, you know, I we'll see. I don't know. I have a hard time understanding what the appeal is for Apple. Apple's done a tremendous job of getting CarPlay into cars. It's basically in every vehicle ever made now, right?
It works. I mean,
it's
great.
Everywhere. So, like, why would you want more than, what do you need beyond that? Like, I mean, I feel like that solves the problem of reaching their audience in these places. Like, I don't know what Apple would contribute to autonomous vehicles.
I don't know the beauty of an Apple device, I guess.
Oh, please. I guess the austere quality of the crypt-like museum that an Apple store is when you go in there, like the, I don't know.
It's interesting. Anyway, Paul,
yeah, I don't know.
Let's wrap it up. Nice quick one today. It's actually an hour. We did almost an hour here today. I thought it would be quicker, but we did an hour. Anything coming up, Paul? Hopefully I'm going to see you soon now that the city's opening up here.
Yeah, that's the first step. So, yeah, I've been talking to my wife about this. We're going to do something. We're going to come to New York at some point.
Do you know what's nuts? Hotel prices as high as they've ever been.
Oh, good.
Nothing is discounted.
Well, that would be a problem.
I like the standard hotel on the High Line. You know, the one that everybody like peeps into the windows. Mm-hmm. It became a huge story. That's one of my favorite places because it's like a lot of stuff to do. My favorite restaurants are there. There's a cool club there or bar, whatever you call it. I looked and I'm looking at the prices have gone up even higher.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
You know, it's like $700 a night. And I called them and I was like, wait, guys, I've been here. That's not the price. He goes, yeah, because not a lot of people are staying. So we got to make up the money. I'm like, but you're.
Well, at least when Billy Joel comes back to the Garden, it'll be like it'll be like one third full. So the tickets will be like three times as expensive. Yeah. That'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I'm willing to bet that's about to happen. So,
what it is. I know.
All right, guys, that's it for this week. All things Paul, go to therot.com. I got a crazy, crazy day here. I actually have a friend in the studio. Kyle's here to talk about wrestling after this.
Jeez, okay.
It's like the old days when I used to do like 15 freaking shows in a day. That's where I'm at right now.
well, have fun with that.
Yeah, thank you. That said, see you guys later.